Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Today, we're going to be talking about Greg Stumbo's investigation and update to that story that we've been talking about in previous episodes. We're going to also update you on Judge Shepard and the UofL board situation in the court system, and we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court's ruling on the minimum wage increase. We also have some quick hits for everybody. So, without any further ado, Jasmine, are you ready to tell us about Greg Stumbo's investigation?
Sure. We've been talking about this kind of once every few episodes as the story has progressed, but if you've missed it, here's the gist. Representative Russ Meyer, a Democrat from Nicholasville, released a voicemail a couple months ago that suggests that Matt Bevin may have threatened him to switch parties. Meyer declined to switch parties, and soon after that, his Nicholasville road project was halted. I believe 2 weeks ago we talked about House Speaker Greg Stumbo created an investigation panel to look into Matt Bevin's actions about these alleged threats to switch parties, to see what's going on with this road project. Why was it delayed? Is there any wrongdoing? Right.
Was there any connection between its delay and the party switching shenanigans?
Right. And so the government ended up paying more in damages than they would have paid for the land that they needed for the project. So this, along with Russ Meyer saying that Bevin threatened him, warranted a closer look for Greg Stumbo. The Bevin camp says that this investigation is silly and political. So last week, Matt Bevin released some emails in an attempt to disprove Russ Meyer's story.
So his side of the story has always been that it was Steve Beshear's fault for going too fast on this project, right?
Right. He believes that the project was rushed, that there was a right-of-way issue with the land. There was land that they needed to acquire. There were issues with utilities. And that's why the project was delayed.
Right. But he released these emails.
That suggested Russ Meyer knew about problems with the project as early as October. And so the email said, Representative Meyer has been keeping close tabs on the project as well. That said, he recognizes the need to clear the right-of-way before letting the project. He also understands we've made some last-minute adjustments and accommodations, and those things don't happen without impact to the schedule.
Okay, so real quick, this is an email from October 2015.
From October, that's right.
So last October.
Right.
And this is an email between a guy named Russell Romine and Matt Bevin?
I think so. Yeah. And Russell Romine was the deputy secretary of the transportation cabinet.
So he's giving an update. Okay, so Matt Bevin's essentially releasing this email that says, to the best of my knowledge, Russ Meyer knew that there were problems. And this guy, Russ Romine, who works in the transportation cabinet, told me that he told Russ Meyer that there were problems. That's what he's saying.
Right. And I guess this may not have been to Matt Bevin. It may have been from Russ Romine to someone else, and then Russ Romine turned that email over.
Gotcha.
I'm not exactly sure where it came from. But this was back in October. The Bevin administration signed the contract for the project on December 10th, which is just 2 days after he took office. So, most of the contract work, including awarding the bids, actually happened under the Beshear administration. Most of the people in government at the time were still Beshear employees.
Well, the Department of Transportation is mostly merit positions, I believe.
Right, and I think that he had appointed someone to the transportation cabinet when it was signed, but most other employees were still from the Beshear administration, and so most of the contract work was done already, but the contract was signed under the Bevin administration.
Right.
Russ Meyer isn't disputing what the emails say, but his position is basically this. If getting the land was such a problem, why did they sign the contract in the first place? Also, he says that they have the land that they needed, and they still haven't begun any work on the project. He's saying, we could have gotten the land. We could have gotten the land at a cheaper price than the damages that we paid. They signed the contract. Now we have the land. There's still no work being done. This is all about me not switching parties.
So it's kind of funny because it seems like Matt Bevin's only defense is, like, I'm incompetent. It's like, man, I just started. I didn't know what was going on. I just signed the
right,
document.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever. That's just a little funny to me. Yeah, it seems like Matt Bevin is saying, you know, most of this work occurred under Bashir's administration. I might have signed the document, but I was just following through in a good faith effort. I thought that the work had been done by the Transportation Cabinet. Russ Meyer is saying, not so fast. This is actually about switching parties. And it seems like that there isn't any clear answer yet. So what has the investigation turned out so far?
So Stumbo's panel met for the first time this past Friday in LaRue County. The panel has four members, three Democrats and one Republican. A second Republican was appointed, but as we discussed last time, he declined to be part of the panel. But they still have an open spot for a Republican to fill. But they met. Documents were presented regarding the timeline for the project, and there is evidence that there were discussions about canceling the project early in the year. I don't think that this necessarily rules out any misconduct, because the voicemail from Matt Bevin to Russ Meyer was from December 2015.
Good point.
So even if there were discussions about canceling the project early in the year, we can assume that's still after that voicemail happened, and I think it ended up being delayed in March. So the panel didn't draw any conclusions, but they have questions about the Transportation Cabinet's protocol for these kind of projects. Their next step from here would be to take sworn testimony from witnesses. Documents were also presented that shows that it would have cost about $200,000 to solve the right-of-way dispute, and then $262,000 for damages for the delay. But this is still quite a bit less than the damages we ended up paying. So that's a little over $450,000. We ended up paying $625,000 in damages, and we're looking at more damages if the project doesn't begin by May 2017. The chairman of the panel said that they're going to look at just the cold, hard facts, and if the cold facts lead them nowhere, then they'll close the door on this committee, and this is over. I don't know if the cold, hard facts are going to be there. I don't want to make any assumptions about what Matt Bevin is capable of or what he would do to get a House majority. But I also don't want to make assumptions that everything he does is official misconduct.
Sure.
So I don't know if this panel will find anything. They're going to take sworn testimony from probably Transportation Cabinet employees, other officials that were involved in the project, and see if that leads them anywhere.
So if there is corruption, it's going to take somebody saying something, or it's going to take some sort of bombshell and some sort of subpoena document.
Right. I'm guessing it would come from testimony of a witness, or like you said, some email or some document
right.
that gets subpoenaed.
Because there does seem to be a level of plausible deniability afoot here. Like you can
yes.
be like, oh, I just don't know. But you know,
right. So I don't know if there's going to be these cold hard facts, and they're saying if there are none, we close the door on this and
yeah.
it's done, and
which,
we'll dissolve this committee.
Yeah, from a political standpoint, seems to be kind of a good move, because even if there aren't any facts, it doesn't mean nothing happened.
Right.
The specter still is around Matt Bevin for this.
And there's also a nice little PDF that actually shows the timeline of this entire project. And so I'll tweet that out from our Twitter account
awesome.
Later so you can check it out.
Great. All right, Jasmine, I'm going to tell you about our favorite judge, Judge Philip Shepherd. Is he your favorite judge? Don't answer that.
Yeah, I shouldn't answer
you
that
shouldn't answer
as
that.
An attorney.
I don't know if he's my favorite judge. I don't know that many judges.
We talk about him quite a bit. He's definitely the most popular judge on My Old Kentucky Podcast.
That's true. So again, Philip Shepherd is the circuit judge in Franklin Circuit Court, which is where all of the state government cases are held. I'm right about that, right?
Right. If it happened in Franklin County, it starts
in his court.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an important spot. It's where a lot of these governmental stuff begins. So we're going to talk a little bit about the University of Louisville Board, which is a story we've been tracking in many episodes. But I believe the last time we talked about it was back in episode 6. And in episode 6, we updated you regarding Judge Shepherd's ruling, which was against Governor Bevin's restructuring of the University of Louisville Board. This was all the way back, I believe, in our first episode where we went over all the details. Listen to that episode if you want to get a better idea about what that was. But essentially, Matt Bevin says he dissolved the whole board and appointed a whole new board. There's many problems with that involving if you're going to dismiss someone from a board, you have to give them a proper procedure.
Some kind of hearing.
And Matt Bevin says, oh, you know, I didn't dismiss them. I just dissolved the whole board. Judge Shepherd said that's a bunch of malarkey.
So that's not quite a restructuring,
right.
is it?
No, it doesn't seem like it. That seems to be the opinion of the court. So Judge Shepard ruled against Governor Bevin's restructuring, saying that no, it was indeed a complete dismissal without hearings, and he had to put the old court back in place. So on October 19th, which was, I guess, last week at some point, Governor Bevin asked Judge Shepard to reconsider his ruling. As is probably predicted, Judge Shepard did not reverse his thinking. His ruling about this specific issue, the ask for a rehearing, I guess, is that the terminology? I don't know. Governor Bevin came to him and said, reconsider it. Judge Shepard said, okay, no, I'm not changing my mind. And his document that he released about this has been called scathing by some people. So here's the big highlight from this document. It says, "It defies common sense and the basic rules of English grammar to interpret these facts to mean that those board members were not removed from office, as the governor argues. While they may have been removed by executive order rather than a letter of termination, they were removed nonetheless. They all served on the board one day and were no longer on the board the next day. This may be inconvenient for the governor's legal argument, but it is a fact." So, scathing, I guess.
Pretty sick burn.
Sick burn, yes. Drop the mic. Walk out,
Dr. Defies the basic rules of English grammar.
Right. That's. This is kind of a weird maneuver a little bit. You may think it's if somebody rules on something and you go back to them a couple of weeks later and like, hey, did you change your mind? But the reason why Governor Bevin would want to do this, to ask for this rehearing, is because if you ask for this, it extends the length of time that you have to file an appeal. So.
Right.
Yeah, Governor Bevin essentially is elongating this process. He's asking for a rehearing so that he has a longer time to file this appeal. The legislature convenes in January, and it might be the governor's strategy to make this process so long, to draw this process out so far, that the legislator's involvement is minimized. You know, if this is something that was heard and completed before the legislature was let in, they could address this from a legislative standpoint. But now it's kind of be a little bit up in the air, so they aren't going to know what to do. And the way that the legislature works in Kentucky is that you have a certain number of days to get all your business done. And this year is actually a short session. This is a session that is not as long as the biennium where you do the budget. This will be the 2017 session will be shorter than usual. So this could be a strategy to avoid the legislature. Okay, so obviously the governor is disappointed in the ruling. Judge Shepard didn't change his mind. He's now stated that he's definitely going to appeal the ruling to the Court of Appeals. But it could be the case that the Kentucky Supreme Court goes ahead and hears this without it going to the appeals court.
Right. That's called discretionary review.
Yes. Why are you giving me the legal story, Jasmine? So, right. When a suit involves the governor and the attorney general, discretionary review is something that is likely to happen, more likely than if I were to sue Jasmine.
Right.
I don't think the Supreme Court would knock that one up to their docket. This is a big deal. It's likely the Supreme Court uses their discretionary review and skips the appellate court and goes straight to them. That's essentially what happened. So a couple of reminders about this issue, just so you know. The Board of Trustees at U of L, as it's currently constructed, the old board, there are 5 vacancies. Judge Shepard actually said that the adequate remedy Governor Bevin had for this issue was that there's 5 people he could essentially...
Right, he has opportunities to appoint people.
Plenty of opportunities, 5 spots. So Governor Bevin has every right to do that, but he is refusing to do that until this winds its way all the way through the legal process. And another thing to remember is that the University of Louisville's accreditation depends on board members' dismissal occurring, quote, only for appropriate reasons and a fair process, which is that's what the accreditation group that does accreditation for universities says has to happen. So the governor's actions jeopardize this. Obviously, this is what the entire court case is about.
There wasn't a lot of fair process, it seems, or any process.
There wasn't any process. The rules of the accreditation and the rules of English grammar were violated. So that's just a reminder that the University of Louisville's accreditation is a little bit up in the air about this. So there's 2 reminders to have. And then I just wanted, before we leave this topic, to give a little bit of handicapping around Governor Bevin's court cases. So the first one, there was a university funding issue, which is ruled for Andy Beshear. The universities are now going to receive all the money that was appropriated to them in the 2014 budget. There is the University of Louisville Board of Trustees, which I believe is likely trending Beshear, based on what the Supreme Court said about the university funding and Judge Shepard's very harsh ruling against Governor Bevin. There's another court case we've talked about at the KRS board with Mr. Elliott, who's on the KRS board, who is now not a full voting member. We've talked about that at length. I don't know what that one does. I said it was leaning Elliot. You think that's fair?
I think that's fair to say, because when the judge allowed Elliot to remain on the board, that opinion had a lot of strong language in it about the threats made and how they brought law enforcement to the board meeting, and he didn't seem happy with how that went down.
But he also didn't seem very happy with Mr. Elliot when he didn't go
the next meeting.
So, you know, that's one of the reasons we're saying, I say it leans Elliot, but it doesn't trend Elliot. I don't know what any of this means. I just made it up on the spot. So there's another court case about the Workers' Compensation Board. The AFL-CIO is suing about, it was essentially the same deal where the board was dismissed and reconstituted with Bevin people. Obviously, labor issues are something that's very different between political parties. Yeah, I said that probably leans the AFL-CIO, who's the plaintiff. Are they the plaintiff if they're suing?
Yes.
Okay, then that leans the AFL-CIO, who's the plaintiff. I think it leans them because of the way that the courts have tended to deal with these board situations. I think it's becoming a little bit more clear that this is a little silly. And then the last piece, the last major court case involving Matt Bevin, is Greg Stumbo is suing Matt Bevin for the way that he did his vetoes. A little bit of procedural jargon. I don't think that case is... It hasn't gotten very much media coverage, and I don't think it is as serious as some of these other ones. I think that one, if Governor Bevin is going to win one, it is most likely to be that one. So, just a little bit of catch-up about Governor Bevin and his many court cases. So, let's talk about another court case involving the minimum wage.
All right, so...
Oh, check out that awesome segue, Jasmine.
That was really great.
We're getting good at this.
I know. This one has to do with Louisville's minimum wage ordinance. So Louisville Metro's minimum wage increase was struck down by the Kentucky Supreme Court last week. And the ruling essentially prevents any city in the state of Kentucky from increasing the wage. This case is kind of about state law superseding local ordinances. It was a 6-1 decision that the ordinance is invalid and unenforceable because the city doesn't have legal authority to set wage floors.
This sounds a little bit similar to last week when we talked about panhandling.
It is similar. The city now has 20 days to ask the court to reconsider, but I think that is probably unlikely since it was a 6-1 decision. The minimum wage would revert back to $7.25, but that doesn't necessarily mean that employers have to reduce the wages. So the hope of minimum wage increase advocates is that employers will keep their wages the same and not punish the workers for this.
Right.
I don't know if that will happen or not. Louisville Metro cites the home rule in their argument. Do you know what the home rule is, Robert?
I have no idea. It's a home run? Home rule?
The home rule is a statute that gives a city the ability to perform functions within the boundaries of the city or functions that further the public purpose of the city, so long as they don't conflict with a state or federal law. That's like when you need some kind of permit or something, you get that through the city, and those are done through city ordinances because they're within the boundaries of the city. That gives a city government the ability to govern unless there's a state law that supersedes it. And that's kind of like what we talked about with the panhandling, that there was a statute that says that only the General Assembly can decide what's criminal.
Right, so the city is saying, you know, we have the ability to raise the minimum wage because of this home rule that says that we can perform functions within the boundaries of the city that further the public purpose of the city. So they think higher wages is something that furthers
the public purpose of the city.
Right. It doesn't necessarily conflict with state law. It would conflict with state law if we were setting a lower wage.
Right.
But because we're raising the wage, it doesn't necessarily conflict, right?
Right. That is the city's argument that the Supreme Court of Kentucky does not buy. The Supreme Court definitely sees a conflict of law here. They say that the state statute sets the minimum wage. I'm going to explain this through the court's lone dissenter, Justice Wright. Justice Wright said that he saw no conflict of laws between the state law and the local ordinance. The state statute sets the minimum wage, but Wright said that the statute requires an employer to pay a wage of not less than the amount set by statute. And so he says the statute was passed to protect workers from being paid a lesser wage. Under his reading of it, a city could increase it, but they couldn't decrease it.
Go below it, yeah.
Right. The majority does not view it as a floor that can be increased like Justice Wright does. They believe that the statute expressly permits a wage, so that statute is permitting employers to set the wage at that rate. Mm-hmm. So that reading of the statute protects the employer, not the worker.
Yeah, because it's in the worker's interest to have a higher minimum wage. And so they're saying that the law was put in place to protect the employer from having to pay a higher wage.
Right. It's an express statute that allows employers to set the wage at that rate.
Right.
That they shouldn't have to set it higher.
Right.
There's also a concurring opinion from Justice Hughes that kind of says, well, you know, the cost of living is much higher in Louisville than it is in the rest of the state. So maybe the legislature could recognize home rule authority in the area of minimum wages, but that would have to be part of the statute. And there's this pretty comprehensive statutory scheme regarding wages, and that would have to be part of it. But as the statute is, there's no room for this.
Right.
So until the legislature does so, Hughes concluded that the ordinance conflicts with state law.
So this guy is saying essentially the legislature can address this problem. You know, home rule doesn't extend to minimum wages because it's not actually in the home rule law that wages are something that this deals with. And
right.
That home rule can be amended by the legislature to include wages. Right.
Right.
Okay. I guess that makes sense. It's kind of interesting because from a federal standpoint, you know, there's a federal minimum wage too, and that's also $7.25. But there's many states and many local jurisdictions outside of Kentucky that set a higher minimum wage, and that's absolutely allowed. Maybe there has been a federal Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, that's addressed this issue at all. But it seems like this is...
I think people have raised it. I don't think it's actually went up.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
But I you also have the 10th Amendment for this type of situation. So,
right.
Yeah, that's a little different, I guess. Well, I mean, this was a big issue in Seattle, Tacoma. They have a $15 minimum wage, which is significantly higher than the
right.
Washington State minimum wage, and that's been able to stay in effect. So, I don't know.
This also affects Lexington. Just raised the minimum wage. It's going to revert back to $7.25. I don't really expect the city to, you know, file a motion to reconsider or anything because the ruling was 6-1. But I hope that employers will continue to pay what they're paying.
So did it already
currently.
Go into effect?
So it was a gradual increase. So I think it had already increased to $8.25 and then was due for another increase to $9 soon.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see if the legislature takes this up. I wouldn't be surprised at all if the House of Representatives stays in Democratic hands for this to be something that's
right.
picked up by the House.
But then does it pass the Senate is the question.
Highly unlikely that a minimum wage increase gets to
right.
the Senate. So
we've been learning a lot about conflicts of laws lately, local ordinances versus state statutes.
2 weeks in a row, but
right?
You know, the news happens, Jasmine. We just react to it. Yeah, so the term of the Supreme Court, I guess it's ongoing. We'll see what they pick up and talk to us about. But we do have the election in a little bit, so we'll talk about that in the future too. Jasmine, you know what it is time for?
Is it time for quick hits?
It is time for the quick hits. Okay, so a couple of quick hits. I actually have several quick hits for you today because I didn't do a second story. I'm a slacker, so I did some extra quick hits for you. The first one, Governor Bevin has not yet filled the Economic Development Secretary opening. So when he was elected, that job was available, and nobody has filled it. There was an acting director who served in that capacity while they searched for somebody new, and that person has said, I've had enough. I'm not doing this job anymore. I didn't want it in the first place. I stayed on to help you out. I'm out of here now. So the acting state economic development secretary is resigning, and that spot will be completely empty until somebody takes this job. So this has been kind of silly. This is an important position. They're in charge of recruiting people to the state of Kentucky to start businesses.
I was about to ask what that job entails.
Yeah, they're in charge of economic development, which, you know, there's lots and lots of things under economic development, but recruiting companies to Kentucky, getting more people hired by the companies in town, creating entrepreneurship opportunities.
That sounds kind of important.
It's very important. The economy is incredibly important.
Especially for Bevin ran on, you know, creating jobs. for Kentucky, and it seems like that this position would be important.
Yeah, that would be very important. It's a very important thing. I don't know. They haven't been able to fill that spot. Second quick hit, Jasmine. Flip-flops and midriffs banned in the executive branch.
Yep.
So there's a dress code change. A little interesting that they, I guess if you work for the executive branch, you could just show up in your
belly shirts,
your belly crop shirts tops. With your flip-flops.
Right.
I'm all for professionalism, and I'm also all for wearing whatever you feel comfortable in. But so I don't know, it's kind of funny to me.
Right. There's some other requirements of the new dress code. I think one is that skirts and skorts must be halfway between the hips and the knees or something like that. And the important part of this is no jeans. I think that's the big one that actually affects people more than the midriffs showing.
Yeah. When I read this story, I just was transported back to high school.
Right. It's like a high school dress code.
It is. And I think high schoolers are a little bit, you know, they want to push the boundaries and they're hormonal teenagers, and that's one thing. Some of them are more hormonal than others. There's very mature high schoolers who wear suits and ties to class, I believe. But regardless, I think it's just a little silly that you're making this an express law. Like, let people do what they're
right.
going to do.
And a lot of these are state workers who don't have contact with clients, constituents, or anything like that. I feel kind of bad for those people who don't really have any contact with people, who can't wear their jeans to work anymore. I know what it feels like to be frustrated with having to be professional every day and dress up. I kind of hate it most of the time. But but some of these positions, like, they don't really have contact. They don't go to court. They aren't meeting with people during the day. A lot of them are just sitting at desks. And so those people can't wear jeans or house slippers or pajamas.
Right. Well,
anymore.
I mean,
that was part of it.
One other
as well.
Thing. Oh, yeah, that's a little silly. But I think, like, there's a lot of talent in the world, too, especially young talent that, you know, would be willing to do these jobs, but are like, if I could have, if there's one thing that makes a difference, you can go to work for the state and lend your talents to make the state government work better or more smoothly, and you have a job in the private sector. And the one thing that makes or breaks it for you is that, hey, I can wear my jeans to this private sector job. That's kind of silly, too. I don't know. It doesn't seem like it makes that much of a difference here in 2016.
It's just weird that they had to, like, enforce this.
Yeah, the thing about the skirts is just dumb. What are they going to do? They're going
to... Right, are they...
Who's going to be the marm right. with the ruler, you know? That who's that person going to be in the state government? I don't even know. Forget it. Okay. Okay. One other quick hit, Jasmine, a couple more for you. There is a major investigation into some PAC corruption. This was on the Telegraph newspaper, which is in the United Kingdom. They essentially tried to get this super PAC that was supporting Donald Trump, the Republican nominee for the United States presidency, to accept $2 million in Chinese money, which is completely not allowed under United States election law. And who got caught up in it but Jesse Benton, who is a former Rand Paul staffer who I believe is either serving a prison sentence or was convicted, at least was
right,
convicted.
I knew he'd gotten into... Yeah. Other trouble somewhere.
He was trying to buy a senator's endorsement. I don't remember if it was for Ron Paul or for Rand Paul, but yeah, that guy got in a lot of trouble. He's connected to Kentucky politics because of the Paul family. Yeah, and just another black eye. I don't know if Jim Gray, who's running against Rand Paul, is going to try to use this guy against Rand Paul, but it seems like the opportunity is there, so we will see if that occurs. And then lastly, and this is something that I think is just silly. Greg Stumbo, he gave an interview to the AP. The AP did a story about Appalachia and the presidential election. And a quote from Greg Stumbo is that, "My opponent can't beat me, but Donald Trump might beat me." Greg Stumbo probably knows this district a little better than me. I believe this about the presidential election, and I believe this about everybody else that's running with or against anybody who's connected to Donald Trump. If you can't beat Donald Trump in an election, you deserve to lose. So, Greg Stumbo, get it together. I believe in you. I think that you're better than that. And I don't think the people in your district are that tied up in the Donald Trump effect. I don't know. This is, I believe...
Do you think that he's saying that more people in his district will come out to vote for Donald
I believe
Trump?
That's
is
exactly
that
what he's
his
saying.
Point?
And I think that this is the KDP's problem in a nutshell. They think that Kentucky voters are stupid. They think that Kentucky voters are falling for Donald Trump and his ridiculous antics, which I personally think that Donald Trump's going to win the state, but I don't think that has anything to do with Donald Trump. I think that has everything to do with how they believe about the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and I think that nobody is looking at Donald Trump and thinking, wow, what a great guy. I can't wait to go out and vote for him.
So, I mean, a few people are. Not many that we know, I don't think.
Well, not. I don't think anybody that we know. I don't know. I just don't think that that's nearly as much of an effect as the Democrats in the state are afraid of. So
Greg Stumbo, get it together.
Get it together. You're gonna win. You're Greg Stumbo.
You're fine.
If you lose, you deserve it. All right, Jasmine. Anything else?
Nope. I think that's it.
All right. Thank you for joining us. Jasmine, people can connect to us on...
on Twitter at MyOldKYPod.
You can find us on Facebook. Search My Old Kentucky Podcast. Show notes on Medium. Listen to us on...
your podcasting app of your choice.
Including iTunes, Stitcher. I think we're on SoundCloud still. I'm not quite sure. But anywhere you want to, you can find us. Search us. We're there. Thanks, Jasmine, for coming and telling me all about Kentucky politics and policy today.
We talked about so much law today.
We did. And I had to talk about law.
I know. You did well.
Made a fool of myself. Okay.
No, you did not.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.